Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. My name is Blake Bettner. We are in studio today. I am joined with Zach Kazan remotely. Zach Kazan, hello, welcome.
Hey guys, how's it going?
We're well. Thank you. I'm also here with Mr. Zach Weiss. Zach Weiss, hello. How are you?
Good. Good. Warm.
Yeah, it's a little warm out here today. You know, I guess that's just summer.
Yeah, it's summer
for us, but
waiting for it to end.
It's really the humidity that that's killer.
It's just gotten really, really hot again in New York City. So complaining.
Yeah, I was telling you as we walked up here, I've got a friend in town who's a runner, so I invited him on my run this morning in Prospect Park, and without really thinking about how much faster a runner he is than me, and the humidity was in full force already at like 6:30 a.m. this morning. So, he kicked my butt. So, but whatever, it's Friday.
And, yesterday there were also some pools of stagnant water left over after the hurricane in the park that were just stinking like brutally, which made the walk through the park not as pleasant.
Not
as
so pleasant. No. Yeah. But you know,
that sounds lovely, guys. That's great.
Yeah. So
that,
come to New York. It's great.
Yeah. That's life. In
wonderful.
Brooklyn.
That's life. Is in Brooklyn.
So it's just the three of us today, and we are going to be talking about some of the new releases that we have seen over the last couple of weeks. There's been some good releases here lately, including a few great ones just from the past week here that we will get into. Before we get to that, Zach Kazan, what is on your wrist?
Today I'm wearing the Worn and Wound Zodiac Super Seawolf Limited Edition that we released earlier in the summer.
Nice. That's a great summer watch.
Yeah, it really is. Super colorful, easy to wear. Yeah. Love this watch.
Zach,
I need to make a winter version next, right?
Yes.
I agree. It's very summery, but I don't know. Once it gets gloomy out, well, I feel like it.
Zach Weiss, what are you wearing on your wrist?
I have on my Everyday Tuna, my Seiko. I don't know the reference number on this. Sorry, everyone.
It's an S in there.
The JDM model with the khaki dial and the gunmetal case.
That a Sage strap?
This is a very dirty Adapt Sage, but it works really well with this color scheme because it's like a few shades darker than usual.
It's a pretty warm dial tone on that, huh?
Yeah, it's nice. I realize I have a thing for black and khaki, and I didn't really even notice that, but then I was looking at my collection. I have three watches with kind of khaki or sand dials and black cases, one of which was our Christopher Ward, which I created that colorway, so I should have noticed. But
who knew?
Yeah. But yeah, so now I have a sub-collection of these, and it's I dig them. They're fun.
It's almost like mustardy from the, like, it veers a little bit into that territory.
It definitely has a touch of yellow in it. It's a very unique dial. And they also do this in like kind of a pale bluish gray, almost like a sage color, maybe a little bit less tonality in that. But yeah, unfortunately, these are JDM, so kind of hard to come by.
Come on, Seiko, get it together. Yeah. No, we love you, Seiko. Keep doing what you do.
It's not like you can't get them over here.
Yeah. If only there were a way. I'm wearing a Rolex Explorer, the reference 124-270, 36 millimeters. It's nice and light. Which is great for a day like today. I actually switched it up. I was wearing my Daytona this morning, but that has a rubber Oysterflex strap on it, and I was a little concerned about how that would fare walking uphill to the studio today in 1,000% humidity. So I threw this on for good measure. I guess I should stop being scared of that kind of stuff. I don't know. Maybe you just let it ride.
I mean, they are sport watches, no matter the material, right? Yeah. I mean, for me, it's just a matter of like, which is comfortable. Like, it's like, and for me, honestly, personally, I don't find rubber or metal that comfortable in the summer. So I get sweaty and kind of irritated either way.
I guess with this, there's something, maybe it's just in my head. I'm like, oh, it's a steel bracelet. I can just like stick it under the sink when I get home and, you know, give it a quick
rinse. It's a lighter
rinse.
Watch in general, though.
And it's just, it's a light watch. Yeah. All right. So that's what's on our wrist. Let's talk about what has been going on. There's been some really cool releases happening lately that we haven't really had a chance to talk to. You've seen them on the site. Where should we start? I thought maybe the first one that we could start with, if it's okay with you guys.
I don't even know where you're going, so just hit
it. Yeah, this could go almost anywhere.
Oh,
yeah.
get ready for it. This is so this was the I guess the four-way collaboration between Messina Lab, Jane Shapiro, Habering and the Orological Society of New York. Yeah. So this had, it brought a lot of people together, and one of the pieces of this was just kind of an also an interesting bit of news in and of itself, mm-hmm. which is the Orological Society of New York now offering the chronometer testing and yeah. certificate. So now like small brands can send their cased movements to the HSNY for testing and chronometry certification.
So I have a question about that, and maybe this was in the article and I just didn't read it, so but what does it matter, like not the timing, you know, I understand that they do the chronometry testing and they test to make sure the movement is within chronometer specs, but like, does the world at large recognize that they are doing that?
From the
world,
perspective,
I mean the Swiss.
Well, I guess so. This, I mean, when I read the release, I was like, oh, interesting. Like, if we had the tools to do that, like, could Warren and Mom start offering?
Well, that's kind of like
certification. Yeah. You know, because it's really just kind of comes down, like, they test it in the various positions, and there's kind of a slew of things that they have, and obviously they.
It
have.
Sounded very rigorous.
Yeah, I mean, not to take anything away from them.
No,
at all.
I think it's incredibly like, cool. In fact, but I'm just wondering, like, yeah, like, is there yet a higher bar, like a power that needs to be, okay, like, you are certified to...
A regulating organ of the regulating bodies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Who regulates the regulators?
Is this too much bureaucracy for you, Zach Kazan?
Yeah, it's easy to kind of get in the weeds a little bit here. I mean, if you really stop and think about it, like who says that, you know, COSC is the, you know, the best standard, or METAS, or any of these other you know, certifying bodies. Like, it's all just kind of, you have to kind of like take them at their word for it to a certain extent, and I think also people are rightly skeptical you know, mm-hmm. sometimes of any of these systems that are used to you know, to certify a chronometer or anything like that.
So should there be a regulating body that sends like you know, like mystery shoppers go into stores and check the service, right? They could send like their own, you know, different samples of movements, and they know that they shouldn't pass, and if they do, I don't know, something like this that like keeps them on their toes.
I mean, I kind of feel like it, like, should to be honest, yeah. You know, just in general, once again, nothing to do with this new New York, but like, you know, there's obviously at least one. There's a COSC. I think there might be another Swiss body that does it as well. There's German bodies. I think there's some in France now. I imagine. I don't know if there's something in the UK, but I don't know. Maybe Roger Smith would be aware of it. Like, but you know, but like, you know, there's that level, and then obviously, you know, I don't think that there is like Japan, Seiko never puts chronometer on a dial, but they regulate to within or beyond those specs, and they have had their own kind of internal use of some other terms, like very finely adjusted and things like that. But those are kind of like historical references, and they used to have chronometer on the dial, but they kind of got booted from the chronometer trials because they were kept winning.
Yeah,
back in this is like in the mid 20th century.
So is there an agreed upon definition of chronometer from like an accuracy standpoint?
Because I feel like from that an accuracy standpoint, there is. It's the plus
two six or
it's 4-6.
4-6, yeah.
Six
yeah.
position. I mean, I don't know about the position, but I think the methodology can change. So like, famously, you know, the COSC, they test the movements pre-casing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, seems to allow for potentially a lot of, you know, bumping around, things that could affect a regulation. Whereas like, I think the German and some of the other testing is after casing,
cased, yeah.
You know, that's all very interesting. Anyway, I hope that, I mean, there's a lot more to talk about that watch, but I mean, I hope the NY,
HSNY.
HSNY. NYSC is the gyms. I hope the HSNY, like, you know, can get this, make this a bit larger part of their, what they do. And that there's just like this now standard, because I think there's a lot of probably brands in America, small independents to maybe some like, you know, like I wonder if like a Vortic or something like that could have an interest in something like this, like a chronometer rated pocket watch conversion, you know?
Yeah, I think that'd be really cool. And for sure, there's a lot in here that that we are probably unqualified to to discuss in too much detail. We should definitely have maybe Nick Manousos on one of these days.
On. Ask him the questions.
Yeah,
his burning questions.
He can tell us how this works. Okay, so the watch itself is Habering Irwing. which is related to the Felix.
Yep.
But it's a dead second watch, is, and the dial was made by Joshua Shapiro, who does lovely dial work.
Rose engine dials.
Beautiful. And then our friend William Messina of Messina Lab ran the design.
He's
the
project manager.
I don't know. He managed all this, these pieces coming together. Yeah. So, what did you guys think of this watch at a glance? Zach Kazan, what do you think?
I think it's a really cool project. I like that it's sort of like a, it's like the super group of collaborations, like all these people kind of
it's a temple
coming
of the dog.
Together.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's just aesthetically, it's really beautiful. I like the dead seconds complication. I think that's a fun, rarely used complication, sort of like an insider-y kind of like watch movement nerd thing.
Yeah.
Shapiro's dials are just incredible. So I'm a pretty big fan of this one, and sold out, I think, in like 10 minutes or something for a watch that's almost $10,000. I think that's pretty impressive. So, job well done by everyone involved.
And this is a Habering built movement, A11MS, I think they call it in here. In-house with this complication, chronometer certified now, I think the value's there. I think the Jaeger LeCoultre Geophysic has a dead seconds that's around $10,000 or $11,000 as well. I don't know, maybe I'm missing some. Do you guys know of any other watches like this?
Seconds. No. Such a funny complication. And like, it's such an ironic complication because the thing that bothers most people about quartz watches is the ticking of the second hand. And then you have you can pay a hell of a lot more to get a mechanical watch that ticks like a quartz watch. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, I assume, but I don't know, honestly, if they have the kind of hand movement issues that a quartz watch has. I imagine they don't. But it's that jerking motion that kind of eventually leads to the drift of the second hand.
Mm-hmm.
You have brands like Grand Seiko that have worked around that with the 9F by putting little hair springs actually in the second hand. So it's like a little whiplash sort of spring there. But anyway, I think about that but it's just such a funny thing. And I don't I don't think I've ever seen a dead beat seconds in person, or if I had, it was fleeting. So I don't really know, does it have a quality to it that is is it this mechanical is there something really heavy?
I would say it probably depends on the watch. A gentleman brought his Longue that had a deadbeat seconds to the pop-up.
That's the one watch I didn't get this
but
season.
There's there's enough else going on with the watch that you don't really hone in on that part to and maybe on there it's a little more romantic because it's a Longue and it's got all the gorgeous qualities that we appreciate about Longue watches. I don't know, but whereas on the JLC, the Geophysic, it just kind of looks like a regular three-handed watch. There it might kind of bother me a little bit more. I love the way that watch looks, just from an aesthetic standpoint it looks fine, but that's all I would look at on that watch. There's nothing else going on there. Who else would be qualified to talk about this? Nick Manuzos.
I wonder if it has any actual benefit to the watch, because I think I don't just keep going back to Grand Seiko, but that high concept movement they did,
the T-Zero
Tourbillon, that had that was a deadbeat second, right? Because it had a remontoir and a whole so there's a whole relationship there, because you have this secondary power reserve, the remontoir, essentially releasing periodically.
And
that's the second tick.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's what's going on here. Is this a buildup of a remontoir? Is it just some sort of gearing?
I think it's a gearing as I understand it, but I'm not exactly qualified. But I'm curious to know about this, actually. This reminds me, I just picked up this book, The Practical Watch Escapement, by George Daniels, following a discussion that you and I, Zach, had had.
Yeah.
That we briefly touched
some
on
light
last week.
Beach reading, probably. Yeah.
But anyways, it took
I'm like, you're reading it on the beach. Somebody's like, oh man, is that a prison escape book? You're like, no, excuse me.
Nerd alert.
It's George Daniels.
Right? Yeah. It's George Daniels. Come on. but getting back to the watch, what do you think aesthetically of the watch?
That was beautiful. I think it's a bit of a strange design slightly with the kind of large Roman numerals at the cardinals on the salmon dial, or really rose gold kind of dial with all the guilloche and everything. But it was striking and beautiful, and like maybe not 100% to my taste, but like I could see a lot of people really liking it. It's just, you know, the Roman numeral thing, I think, is part what kind of like that would take me a little bit of time to kind of appreciate. It's just, it's a little old school.
It was, yeah. But the whole execution, there was something, I don't know, modern about it. I don't know, there was definitely something about it that, not that it left me scratching my head, but there was a lot to kind of take in and digest with it, I think. And I thought it was a pretty nice looking watch, but again, not the kind of watch that I would like own and wear all that often. But I'm glad that it exists. I was really enthusiastic to see this kind of come together the way that it did. So congratulations to all parties involved on that one. All right, so let's move on. There's a number of Grand Seikos to talk about.
There's a number.
There's a few.
There's a few, right? So, Zach, you wrote about the SLGA 007 and 008. We had, so our esteemed colleague, Mr. Blake Mallon, was in Las Vegas and got to see these watches hands-on. Unfortunately, he's not back here with us, but he did send us some live shots, and these watches looked quite lovely. The blue dial in particular looked really beautiful on this watch. What's the story with this, Zach Kazan?
So these watches feature a new spring drive movement, basically, that Grand Seiko created. It's based on the spring drive movement that they released last year or earlier this year that debuted in a dive watch, Grand Seiko Diver. The reference number escapes me at the moment, but it's a thinner 5-day spring drive movement. And I remember writing up that dive watch at the time and wondering, you know, why did they, you know, create this new movement and put it in a big chunky diver? Finally, we have a variation on the movement, slightly different because they've moved the power reserve to the rear of the watch. You can see it from the through the exhibition case back, but this is a watch that takes full advantage of the thin caliber, and it's kind of a companion piece to the White Birch, you know, which used a similarly kind of like next generation high beat movement that was made to be thinner. This is that in spring drive form, kind of represents like a higher end, you know, Grand Seiko, kind of like next gen technology, you know, higher price point, you know, more finely finished case. It's the 9 series case, you know, which Zach, you wrote about in the in the White Birch review that we ran.
This
recently
is the same case as the White Birch.
It seems almost identical. Maybe there is like I'm not sure if the thickness is literally the same between the two, but it might be. If it isn't, it's like within 0.1 millimeter or something. Yeah.
Certainly the same design language, the handset and dial markers appear to be, you know, quite similar, if not identical. Yeah. And so they did the SLGA 007 and the SLGA 008, which is a rose gold tree ring dial version of the watch with the same thin 5-day spring drive movement. They're both, you know, really gorgeous. I'm really looking forward to seeing the blue dial, the SLGA 007 in person at some point. This is personally for me the kind of watch that I've been waiting for from Grand Seiko, with a thinner spring drive movement, and it looks great.
Yeah, the blue dial looks really beautiful. Kind of like evokes like a wave, gentle lapping pool kind of thing.
In the photo that Blake Mallon sent from Las Vegas, which was I think also in one of our stories on Instagram, probably gone by the time this is airing, unfortunately.
Sorry
about that. It really looked just like water frozen in a moment.
Yeah,
you know, like the way the sun was hitting it. It's really like almost surreal looking, like a miniature ocean.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. And I love that they moved the power reserve, of course. People have been kind of... I wonder if that will be like in time, like the quirky early Grand Seikos that had the power reserves on the dial will be like a sought after thing.
I wonder if they'll ever do that with like the movement that's in like the Grand Seiko I have, the SPGA 375, which is like at this point like a wholly different, you know, architecture. At least it seems, you know, I mean, it's certainly aesthetically very different. And I feel like it represents, that kind of older generation. And then these new ones are this higher generation or this newer generation. So I wonder if they'll leave that you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if people, you know, it's on, I saw somebody, some Instagram comments wrote, were like, they liked the power reserves there because to them, it reminded them of the like journey that Seiko engineers had to take to get to the 72 hour power reserve, which was like a decades long fight. I mean, the, you know, sure. The whole story of the spring drive and how it came about is a really interesting story.
Yeah.
Chuck Forster wrote some really good articles on that. So like to him, we like celebrated that and like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think it's all about the dial on mine, the flat blue dial, or, you know, there's, it's not interrupting anything.
I don't so even know like it. Yours, so.
Yeah. It's, and it's, you know, it's part of that watch. I don't have other watches with power reserves, so yeah. I think it's cool. Whereas on something with a heavy texture like this, or like the Snowflake, kind of interrupts that. So here, I think it's really, you know, just super elegant. I think it's also just really interesting, though, that there's, you know, from the top side of these two watches, the White Birch and the 00, it's the 7? It's a 007. Oh, yeah, because somebody called
007
it
007 is the stainless steel.
The blue one, yeah.
I saw a joke, I think it was in Hodinkee's comments on their article, but it was like, they need to call this Pond, Lake Pond or something, like, 007.
The 007.
Pond.
Yeah,
pond.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We got gotcha. You.
There's been multiple.
Easier to remember than the reference number, for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, now I'm confused. But what was I saying? That, like, yeah, from the dial side only, like, there's the watches are so similar. They're even a very similar price point now, the White Birch and the,
yeah.
And like, but the movements now are so wildly different. I mean, different technologies, both proprietary, which is really interesting, but also like aesthetically really wildly different, which is, you know, something I wrote about in like my White Birch review is that that movement, the 9SA5, if I believe so,
yep,
is so classically decorated. Particularly for Grand Seiko. I mean, you have like certain types of bridges and beveling and Côte de, well, not Côte de Genève, but like that kind of style of graining and perlage, and even this the way the rotor is skeletonized and the words are etched on it just feels very European. That's not a bad thing. It's beautiful movement.
Yeah.
Whereas this feels so the opposite. I mean, it's like a single bridge. Yeah. The shape, the finishing on it, it's all flat sanded, which is very subtle. The shape of the rotor has this kind of like elegant kind of, I don't know. It's just, it's straight. It's a little interesting to me.
Yeah. But, yeah. I think they're beautiful, watches for sure. And I had a note to talk about the review, as well. And I guess it's kind of analogous to this watch, especially if it's in the same case.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to, we finally got to spend some time with the White Birch. What did it live up to the kind of hype surrounding it? Was there anything that you found disappointing about it, or was it just all
so
perfect?
It's not. It's the one. My one like critical takeaway, which is, you know, I think something that would be entirely dependent on just your personal tastes when it comes down to these things, was the 22 millimeter lug width on the 40 millimeter watch.
Yeah,
that's quite wide for 40 millimeters. But on the bracelet, at least from the top down, it kind of feels almost like an integrated lug bracelet, and it wears very nicely. When you turn your wrist to the side, the kind of lack of a harsh taper, at least in the bracelet, it's only a 2 millimeter taper, is very visible because it suddenly is quite a lot of metal on the side. And then I did find when I put it on a strap, which I tried, that the lugs felt very narrow. Mm. Like because of the 22 millimeter lug space, like the lugs themselves aren't very thick,
sure, yeah,
which you don't see when there's the end link in there,
yeah.
So, but maybe, you know, that just being hyper picky, I in general rarely like 22 millimeter straps. Like it's almost immediately turns me off from a watch because of the weight of all those straps. Like you almost need a 6 millimeter taper
yeah,
on a 22
yeah.
millimeter strap to really feel, I don't know, comfortable to me. So
yeah.
I mean, I'm definitely a bit of a bias there. But yeah. Like that one thing aside, the rest of the watch is absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
I don't own any watches that are in that near $10,000 price range, but this seems to live up to anything I'd expect from one, particularly the movement.
Yeah.
But the finishing, I mean, it's if you appreciate Grand Seiko's finishing on other Grand Seiko watches, like it's all there. It's all in spades. Like there's a lot more of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like. There's just lines of polish followed by lines of brushing by more polish, and like every single moment is touched on that. And then like the markers are more ornate, the hands are a little bit, it's just like,
yeah,
you know, it's a piece of art. So.
Yeah, it really is. I think you that was your comment on the lug span. The proportion of the lug span to the size of the case is the only thing that really threw me off on it as well. And then the fact that the bracelet doesn't taper at all. So if you, like you said, if you kind of catch it from the side, or if you look at it from the bottom, like it looks like you're wearing a gigantic wrist, or a gigantic watch is probably on your wrist, but it's really not. I mean, if the head of it feels just fine on the wrist, obviously it's fine.
And
but
it's thinner for a grand seiko. It's like 11.7 or something, which you know is actually also just like a totally, to me, respectable thickness for like an everyday watch. Yeah. Like, you know, it's when things kind of get into that 13-14 for like a time only that it's like, well, why is this so thick? It also, because it wears really low and it's really sleek, so that the size of the bracelet honestly gets emphasized a little bit more, because the proportions of the head are so like more spot on than other grand seikos.
Yep, 100% agree. I think a 20 millimeter lug span and maybe a slightly more well proportioned bracelet, and this would be an absolute home run. I think it's still absolutely beautiful though, and worth every penny for people who were lucky enough to get one.
Now I don't know if I would choose which you would choose.
Oh, which of these two?
The white perch or this pond one.
Well, you have a blue dial.
Right. Well, we're getting like literal, but just like, you know, the case is about the same. The dials are both stunning. You know, one's silver, one's blue, obviously. You have a dual impulse 80-hour high beat, which is the only one out there, period. Or a movement that's plus minus 10 seconds, I think, or within 10 seconds a month, because it's even slightly more accurate than their previous generation of spring drive. It's a tough one.
Half a second a day. It's mind-blowing, like how,
how
accurate these watches are.
But there was another trio of Grand Seikos that really seemed to be getting a lot of attention.
True.
Especially at the time of this recording. This is the three SBGW 273, 275, and 277, I believe. Yeah. And these are three different shades of green. And this is their 37.7 millimeter, I believe, hand-wound watch. The 231 maybe is the one with the white dial.
Yeah, sounds right.
That's been kind of like, it's been there for a while.
It's a sleeper.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Grand Seikos,
yeah, and I love it because it doesn't have a date on it. And, you know, the case size obviously is beautiful. The case is beautiful, and it's got that lovely hand-wound movement, and it's like a good price at under $5,000. So this is, it's in that same case. It's the same size. It's the same movement, but it gets these three new dials, and they all are representative of different areas in this valley in northern Japan near this volcano where they took their inspiration from, as they are known to do with a lot of these things. So the greens are kind of references to like little details that you would find in this very specific region of Japan. And they are not the greens. They're not just, oh, that's green, right? No. They are, they almost defy any adjectives that you would put to them, and we've seen
three new greens.
They're three new greens, and honestly, like, we've seen quite a few pictures of them now, and some live shots of them from people in Las Vegas, and they almost look different in every single one that I've seen. I feel like these are watches that you are going to need to see in the flesh, but they aren't just different colors. They have a light texture to them as well, maybe like a wind-whipped grass, or I don't know how you would even describe it. How would you guys describe it?
I think I think wind-whipped grass kind of appealing. sounds about right.
But
I
not long that, grass.
Yeah, it's like short grass.
Short
it's
grass.
Like like you hit the fairway. Yeah. It's a shorter grass.
It's also a touch linen-y-esque.
Linen-y. Maybe that's the better. Linen-y. Yeah.
It's called Kirazuri, I believe, is what it's called, and it's like based on a painting method.
And they've
used it before. So there's a few spring drives from a couple of years ago in 44 GS cases, which I don't remember the reference numbers on, but there's one that is very popular, the steel one. There was a steel one, a platinum one, and a gold one. The steel one has this very, very pale light blue dial, which I've seen in person. Actually, somebody came to the pop-up once again with that, and I didn't realize it was the same method to do these two until I was reading a little bit deeper, and having seen that in person, it's like a lot of little like, crisscrossing sort of lines that build color. It's very interesting,
and it's just kind of how it throws light off of it, really, at the end, like when you like it's I don't think you know, at a normal distance, you wouldn't look at your watch and like notice the texture. Like, it's something that you really have to kind of like look for. Yeah. Zach, like the watch that you have, the green dial, that is a similar, like, you don't really notice the texture until you like really kind of get up close and personal with it. But how it throws light off of it is really affected by that. And I feel like that's the situation here.
Yeah, no, that's the, well, that's the thing I love about my watch, the SBGH271, which is a green dial watch with some textures, that you don't notice that texture if you're just kind of glancing at it and checking the time, but it really comes alive if you, you know, if you get the watch out into the sunlight, and it varies so much in you know, like the tone of the green and the you know, just like how that texture appears. And it seems like from the some of the live photos that we've seen you know, from Las Vegas, that these watches have kind of a similar characteristic. They're really really beautiful, and I'm a big fan of the cream dial you know, hand wound version of this watch. It's a watch I've thought about buying you know, many times. It's absolutely beautiful. The case size is perfect for a watch of this type. So yeah, these watches will be very, very popular and highly sought after, I think.
Yeah, I think so. So the greens are teal. One's like teal, one's like lighter kind of warmer green, and then there's a third that's kind of like straightforward green. I'm not going to attempt to name any of them though.
Yeah, and just like, yeah, the 277 sort of a seems to be a grassier green.
Yeah,
some photos almost make it look almost like an olive green. Then yeah, the 275 is a blue teal kind of thing.
Teal, yeah,
seems very dynamic. And then that the 273 is the one that I find the hardest to kind of put my finger on, because it's
light.
It's very yellow
in there. Yeah.
It's almost champagne.
And it has a blue seconds hand.
It's the only one with the blue seconds hand, which is very cool. Yeah. It's a, you know, heat blued.
I wonder why that was the only one that got. I guess the dial is light.
Lighter dial watches, but you know, in the I guess I forget, what was it? The 231 was the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a JDM version of that. I guess the number's probably different, but that has a blue second hand on it too.
Yeah. Okay. And a bracelet too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People like those. I don't know. Just adds a little more contrast to it. Maybe just needed it with the lighter dial. But yeah, I like that one. I think they're all beautiful, but that one I just can't really tell what it is. I don't know. It's very weird. It's an elusive color in photos. They all are. All three of them are. I mean, they really. Yeah. I've been trolling Instagram for the last few days trying to find other shots from people in Vegas and whatever, and like, you know, Hodinkee has a bunch of shots, a blog watch has a bunch of shots, various people have shots, and like, really, like you said, none of them are the same.
They're all different.
They're all different. Yeah. Hodinkee took shots that looked like indoors on some of the green ones, so it was very much more matte, and I don't know, totally changed the character of it.
Yeah. Yeah, Blake had some out in the sunlight, didn't they? Yeah. You know, it was like a totally different personality for sure. So these are cool. I think they were sadly gone.
Yeah, they were limited to 140 a piece, and it was U.S. only. Yeah. So that's a very small number for Grand Seiko, especially one at that price point. They tend to
Because they were like $4,700, something like that. $4,750, I think.
Something, yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what those end up realizing, I guess, in the secondary market. But if you got one, congratulations. Keep it. Wear it around. Unless one of you wants to buy one secondhand, in which case, hit us up. All right. So let's move on to another collaboration. This with Oris and Hodinkee. Yeah. So this was a Diver 65. In the 38 millimeter case, steel, with the caliber 400 in it, and a green dial, So this is also kind of sold out quick. But I think
that's not a green dial though. That like I feel like.
So I saw a live shot of this that somebody put on Reddit, and it read as green. More
okay,
green
okay. The photos to me, like if you had told me it was gray, I just would have believed it was gray.
Yeah,
you know, not that I don't think they know colors and the difference between colors, but I did not see green in those photos. Like, we have gray mics in front of us, so it almost looked like the same gray.
And we've talked about how big experts we are in identifying hues before.
We've taken a test. None of us are colorblind.
See, this is a warm gray though.
Yeah, it's true. It's almost a green.
Yeah, and I would. This looks about like the color of that dial. But the live shot I saw did read a little more green. But this is it's dateless. It has kind of like the old school presentation of the logo there. This was a watch that I think we were all kind of thinking, well, A, when we saw the cotton candy watches, We're like, oh, awesome. This is the case size for this watch that we've been waiting for. We would love to see it in steel. Here it is. They put the Caliber 400 in it, though, so that drove the price up a little bit more.
Just a little bit.
But it's fine. They're all gone, and congratulations if you got one. It's a lovely watch. But it exists. They make this case in steel in this size. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about that.
Yep.
Will we see it with a SW200 or 300?
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of this watch in particular? Did you care for it? Was it a hit or miss?
I liked it. You know, I don't want to like join in with the angry masses over the price, but like it, you know, and I totally get the movement and everything, and I like the movement, and it makes total sense to me as an Oris product. But this watch was more stripped down, and it felt even more kind of toolish and kind of fun, and I don't know, like I felt like the price point should have gone the other way. Mm-hmm. Not that there's any way to have done that per se, but like if there had been, you know, that would have really clicked. It would have all just made total sense. Instead, it was this like really cool casual steel version of that this new case, and it was sort of like a reduced bezel and everything. It had a real like fun beater look to it.
Yeah.
Put a $3,800 price tag on that, and I no longer want to.
Kind of throws that.
It's just.
I mean, that's, and you can get the new. I mean, let's just face it, a Black Bay 58.
Yeah, it's in more competitive waters.
Yeah.
Now, I did see people say, you know, I bought this, I wanted this, and, you know, all my buddies have Black Bays or Black Bay 58s, and I wanted something different, and this is exactly what I was waiting for. And that's great. And, you know, I didn't find this watch offensive by any stretch. I thought it was lovely. Yeah. But I can see where people...
Yeah, I don't know. When I saw it, my brain contextualized it as like I wanted it to be more casual, I suppose. And to me, that casual relates more to less price and more maybe of a... Even if it's more pedestrian movement, a less special movement, but like...
But still a great movement. There.
Also, yeah, no, I mean, anything... I mean, the first Hodinkee Ellie they did was a hand-wound. So that's the... 210 or something like that, and you know those were 1500. I might be wrong with the price point, but
that's great.
They kind of did it then. They made it less expensive, so like, or at least around the same price. You know, it just.
But this is the case size you want.
Oh yeah, no. I'm still super eager to see the 38 millimeter Diver 65 in steel in whatever form it comes out with.
Yeah.
Out in next, or you know.
It has to happen at this point, right?
Like, yeah, I would assume so.
Yeah.
I assume so. Yeah.
What did you think of this watch, Zach? Any what's your hot take?
Yeah, I mean I don't have a hot take. I kind of agree with both of you guys that it's nice to have this, like, we've confirmation, like they're making this case in 38 millimeters in steel. Yeah. When I reviewed the 38 millimeter cotton candy, that was kind of like the thesis of the review. Like, I want this watch in steel at this size. I guess I will join into the chorus of it's too expensive. Like, it's just like, it just feels like, you know, it, because we've lived with the Diver 65, in this format at a certain price point for so long, it's just hard to like adjust to seeing it at a, you know, that like basically twice the price retail. Yeah. So that's that's something that we'll just have to get used to as Oris continues to work this movement into their into their catalog. And my hope is that like this movement coexists with the off the shelf movements, at least for a period of time, so that people have a choice. But I would be all over this if it were. A Sellita movement at a Sellita price point, because I love the case size.
Yeah, at least that's our collective hot take.
Mm-hmm.
Luxury watch is our too expensive. Just in general, like, that's just our blanket thought here.
How cool would it have been if they and like this would have never. There's no universe in the multiverse in which this happened, but like that they used like a Miyota 9015 in it or something. Oof. Like that. You know, I mean, that's just literally impossible.
It was like $800.
Yeah, I mean, when that. Yeah. What about two?
Yeah,
not really.
Yeah,
but what about one?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no shame there. All right. So there's one other watch that I wanted to talk about. And that is a new chronograph from Fair. This is a new Seagrave. And it is a monopusher chronograph with a big eye dial. And so they have done the Seagrave before, and it's more of a traditional like dual register symmetrical dial, dual pusher, all that business. So this is kind of building on that. There's some slightly new colors. It's still a black dial, but the hands, the timing seconds hands, the minute hand, and the running seconds hands are all like, you know, red, green, and blue or something like that. Yeah, but the rest of it is like black, so it doesn't like shout at you in the way that some of other Ferrer watches have done. Which is great, by the way. I like colorful Ferrer watches. But this feels like a watch that you could approach every single day and wear if you wanted to. It also has a slightly new case design, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
It has this engraving on the side. It's just stunning.
So cool.
I like this watch a lot.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it since it came out. I mean, I obviously own a Ferrer chronograph, but wildly different. And mono pushers are quite
cool.
Uncommon. Yeah. Luckily, you know, Sellita now makes movement, the 510 or whatever it is that had this. So like, it's no longer like, I think, as much of a challenge for a brand to make one, let alone one at just around $2,000, which was like before Hanhart really owned the affordable, you know, quote unquote, mono pusher.
Yeah.
Other than that, I mean, Mont Blanc or something, you had to pay like $5,000 or so. But, it's just, I mean, this is like a lot of cool things coming together. Yeah, but absolutely. Then.
And it's just under $2,000. Like 19 and some change, I think. So, it's all that like kind of unique Ferrer stuff. And it feels to me like it's even matured a little bit more in this. And I feel like every kind of iteration that we're seeing from them is kind of like dialing it in like a little bit further and a little bit further. And this just kind of feels like, ooh, I really like this. And I think he's got, I know he's referenced maybe another one of these coming out later this year. So I would love to see maybe a different color. I guess that's always, I hate knowing that because I'm like, oh, I like this, but what if I like the other one better? So you find yourself just perpetually waiting for, I got to wait for the, that's like me with Grand Seiko right now.
Yeah.
Like I've been waiting for maybe like the right one to jump on. I'm like, well.
It's kind of like watch world right now.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. It's kind of the nature of being deep into this hobby, I think.
And then disappointment when you missed out and whatever, like, I think we all have a few of those these days because the window to buy things has become so narrow.
Yeah. So you all just have the FOMO all the time.
Yeah.
And that's no good. That's not fun. No. Zach Kazan, what do you think about mono pushers and what do you think of this watch?
Mono pushers are great. I'm a fan. And I like this watch. I think, we talk about it a lot, but like Ferrer just has a real knack for picking the right colors that you wouldn't necessarily expect to look great together always look great when they when they actually execute these dials. And I agree, the case is really cool. I love that little the engraved piece on the case band. I think it's kind of a unique touch. You don't see that too often these days, and it's very nice, very nice. And it's priced really well too. It's a good price point for a watch like this.
Yeah,
and their finishing, I mean, speaking from experience, like their finishing is always even better than you think it's going to be in person somehow. Yeah. They're really high quality watches. And yeah, I mean, I can't think of another watch with a case side like that. I mean, except for maybe like if you could sort of say like a Braymont, because they have that barrel
triptych.
So it's kind of like a screwed in anodized aluminum barrel that's been knurled. But this is a very different effect because it's like inlaid into the case side, so
it's kind of like texture. It's got like a curvature to it, and it's kind of narrow. I'm really curious to see.
I just feel like seeing that on your wrist with like, put that on like a rally strap, you had some like driving gloves on, racing.
Look the business,
even
just sim racing on your computer at home.
Yeah, well, that's right? Let's be honest. No. That's what's happening.
It's more our speed, maybe.
Mario Kart and just screaming at kids,
Now we're talking. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not a screw down pusher, most importantly. So,
can you imagine a screw down mono pusher? That is like that. I hope somebody makes that. It's like that'd be the most annoying watch on earth.
Zach's nightmare. make you a piece unique just for you, Zach, with a screw down mono pusher,
and with that, not a screw down crown, a screw down mono pusher, though. And like,
congrats to Ferrer. It's a lovely watch. There, and we look forward to seeing where it goes next. And then I guess finally, if we wanted to touch on Zach, we did a second of our missed reviews this week, and you did the IWC 3706, and you kind of came down on them for not being a little bit more like they used to be in the past with this watch. Do you have any other big takeaways that you want to talk about?
I mean, I just love that watch. You know, it's your watch. So you graciously lent it out to me for an extended period of time to wear and spend some time with. And my takeaway is it's just like perfectly proportioned. Like 39 millimeters is a great size.
Yeah.
It's thick, like by the numbers, but it doesn't wear thick, you know, because of the way the case sits on your wrist. And it's just like a really, it's just a really well executed kind of like everyday watch. It's not even that it's like a pure tool watch. It's just like a, I don't know. It's like, it's just a really nicely made thing. And like IWC has become this very much like a luxury brand. And like, they've always been, they were certainly a luxury brand in the 90s and the early 2000s when this watch was made, but they've really kind of leaned into it, you know, in the recent past. And they make like, you know, like very high priced luxury objects. And this is like the opposite of that, I think in every way. So it's purpose built. It's really well made. And that's just like a really solid design, and I really enjoyed wearing it. And
yeah, it's
I'm,
a cool
I'm
watch.
Looking for one. Like I want to own this watch someday. It's great.
Yeah, well, the getting's good for sure. I think these are a great watch for the money, and it's just a really well machined watch. And there's no like pretense of luxury to it. There's no like they didn't sneak anything in there that says, well, this is still a really high end luxury watch. You know, like it's just a very straightforward. Matte black dialed, you know, brushed everything. It's it's just easy to wear and get along with, and it doesn't feel at all like, ooh, I'm getting dressed up. I gotta like show off or something like that. Yeah.
Does that one have the fish on the crown? Or is it only?
Yeah. Yep. It's got the Jesus fish on the crown.
Such a funny detail.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that though.
I think it's the case maker, right?
I thought it meant. I don't know. I thought maybe it had to do with it being water resistant. Like that was the mark.
Yeah, that was always my impression too. But
that would make a lot more sense than what I just said. We're gonna cut
the
that.
The case maker is like, when we sign everything with a big fish. I kind of like that.
I think it was the Bob Burger episode where they get the Tina draws the fish on the side of the bag when the bank robbery. Anyways, because it was easy to draw is her reasoning for doing it. Like, at any rate, it's. Yeah.
Bring back the fish.
Bring back the fish. Yes. More watches like this, please. It's a great one.
Classic soul watches with the blunted hand.
I mean, that's the squared off hour hand. We love
part
that.
Part what really right. makes it for sure.
Yeah. All right. Any closing thoughts? What are you guys working on? Are you guys reviewing? Zach Weiss, what are you reviewing right now?
I am reviewing, albeit a bit slowly. it's one of a few things I'm doing. The Atowak Ettore, which it's that a Wandering Hour watch that when it was on Kickstarter went for around $450. I think the full retail price is like $1,200.
Yeah,
I mean, I'll be reviewing it because of the Wandering Hour aspect of it, though. I don't know. There's some other interesting things going on here.
Yeah, that watch is a trip.
It is a trip. I don't know. Sometimes you just gotta review a weird watch.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, yeah,
that's just how it goes.
We're here for it. What about you, Zach? Do you have anything? Do you need something?
Putting the finishing touches on that Delft Watchworks Oostpoort, which that might even be posted by the time this airs. I'm not exactly sure where that is on the calendar, but that's coming real soon. What else am I working on? Send me a watch, Blake.
Okay.
Let's send me something to review. I'm ready.
Yeah, we've got a few watches on my desk right now. That Airrain Type 20 is one of them.
Yeah.
Neos. Yep, the Pollen. I think Ed Jelly is gonna take those out. Yeah, we've got some cool watches and even a couple of really cool ones incoming. One actually that is a watch that you wrote about on intro, the Porsche Design. Timer thing is on its way to us right now.
Very cool.
Which I'm pretty excited to see. That's a pretty slick looking watch, I think. So we'll have a lot more to say about that one coming up soon. But what do you think? Leave your thoughts on any of the watches that we discussed today in the comments below, or shoot us a note on Instagram. Did we miss something that you really liked that released that you would like to hear our thoughts on? Let us know. We are here for you. Until next time, as always, thanks for listening.